Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along. It's been close to Australia Day. We thought we'd have a discussion on matters relating. Both of our speakers tonight have spoken for us before and been published in the Sydney paper, so I welcome them back with brief introductions. David Smith was here last year when his book Head of State came out. So Sir David Smith, former Secretary to Australian Governors General and author of Head of State, and Dr. Helen Irving, lecturer, Sydney Law School, and historical consultant for Film Australia's documentary Federation 1999. And the discussion we're having is a Mate for Head of State ? A discussion. So as you know, we don't have formal debates, but David Smith's going to state his view, Helen Irving's going to state her view, then we'll have a question discussion period finished no later than 7. So we kick off with Sir David Smith. Welcome back. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Dr. Irving, ladies and gentlemen, at the outset, let me assert that we already have an Australian mate as our head of state in the person of the Governor-General. As Dr. Gerard Henderson has correctly reminded readers of the autumn 2006 number of the Sydney Papers, when I entered this debate in 1991, shortly after my retirement as official secretary to the Governor-General, and for some years afterwards, I accepted the conventional notion that the Queen was monarch and head of state, and the Governor-General her representative. But after delving into the archives, I discovered material that was not known to me when I headed the government branch of the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet, nor was it known to me during my time as official secretary to the Governor-General. It was also not known to the Governors-General, whom I had the privilege of serving, a point which Dr. Henderson has also alluded to by pointing to the writings of Sir Paul Hasluck in 1972 and Sir Zelman Cowan in 1985, many years before I began my research. So my withers are completely unwrung by being reminded of views which I once held. Changing one's views in the face of more and better particulars is not yet a sin. Dr. Henderson also quoted with approval from Vernon Bogdanore, a distinguished commentator on the British Constitution, who simply asserts, but without evidence, that the Queen is Australia's head of state. Bogdanore is an expert on the British Constitution, but he is dead wrong, thank you, about the Australian Constitution. Bogdanore lists the functions of a head of state, but he overlooks the fact that in Australia, those very functions are carried out by the Governor-General and not by the monarch. The second point on which Dr. Henderson places great reliance are the reasons given by Attorneys General Darrell Williams and Philip Ruddock for describing the Queen as our head of state, namely, that it is appropriate and proper. Dr. Henderson chides me and my monarchist colleagues for rejecting the views of the Attorneys General and for arguing a proposition for which he claims we have no legal authority. On the contrary, we have a great deal of legal authority for our view, and I'm about to set it out. It is the Attorneys General who have no legal authority for their view, and when challenged to provide their evidence, neither could provide any. On the other hand, my evidence is set out in some detail in my book, Head of State, the Governor-General, the Monarchy, the Republic and the Dismissal, published by Macleay Press in 2005, forgive the commercial, and launched by former Governor-General Bill Hayden. The time limitation placed on me this evening allows me to refer to that evidence only briefly. It is true, as Republicans regularly remind us, that the Governor-General is the Queen's representative. Section 2 of the Constitution says so. Sadly, many Republicans stop reading the Constitution once they reach Section 2 and repeat the mantra that the Governor-General is the Queen's representative and not the head of state. But if they were to press on to Section 61, they would find that the Governor-General is indeed both. Section 61 reads, and I quote, "The executive power of the Commonwealth is vested in the Queen and is exercisable by the Governor-General as the Queen's representative and extends to the execution and maintenance of this Constitution and of the laws of the Commonwealth," unquote. Republicans love to latch on to the words, "as the Queen's representative," as if they placed some limitation on the Governor-General's powers under this section. But the words are merely descriptive, not prescriptive, as was made clear in a 1975 legal opinion by the Commonwealth Solicitor General and by the 1988 report of the Constitutional Commission. And I shall return to those later. When our founding fathers set about drafting our Constitution, they had the Canadian Constitution to guide them. The distinctions they made in the Australian Constitution were quite deliberate. The Canadian Constitution, and later the New Zealand Constitution, recognised the Queen as head of state. Ours does not. In 1947, King George VI signed letters patent transferring all head of state powers from himself to the Governor-General of Canada. In 1983, Queen Elizabeth II did the same for the Governor-General of New Zealand. No such transfer has been necessary in the case of Australia, because our Governors-General received their powers from the Australian people via the Australian Constitution in 1901. To further highlight the deliberate distinctions made by our Founding Fathers, while our Section 61 provides that the executive power of the Commonwealth is vested in the Queen and is exercisable by the Governor-General, the equivalent Canadian provision simply vests the executive government of Canada in the Queen. And while our Section 68 provides that the Command-in-Chief of the naval and military forces of the Commonwealth is vested in the Governor-General, the equivalent Canadian provision vests the Command-in-Chief of the Canadian naval and military forces in the Queen. Australian Republicans are not the only people to fail to recognise the unique features of our Constitution. Queen Victoria's advisers in 1900 suffered from the same handicap. On the 9th of July 1900, Queen Victoria assented to the Commonwealth of Australia Constitution Act. On the 17th of September 1900, Queen Victoria proclaimed the 1st of January 1901 as the date for the establishment of the Commonwealth of Australia. So far, so good. On the 20th of October 1900, Queen Victoria signed letters patent and royal instructions relating to the office of Governor-General of Australia. Big mistake. Two of our constitutional scholars who had been involved in the drafting of our Constitution, Inglis Clark and Harrison Moore, wrote in 1901 that Queen Victoria's letters patent and royal instructions were superfluous or even of doubtful legality. They pointed out that our Constitution gave to our Governor-General powers and functions not given to any other Governor or Governor-General within the British Empire, and that in doing so, the Constitution had deprived the Crown of the right to purport to recreate the office 4 months later and to give instructions to the incumbent. 84 years later, on the 21st of August 1984, Prime Minister Hawke advised the Queen to revoke Queen Victoria's letters patent and royal instructions on the grounds that they should never have been issued. However, a lot of constitutional water was to flow under the bridge between 1901 and 1984. In 1916, during a Canadian case before the Privy Council, the Lord Chancellor, Lord Haldane, commented on the absence from the British North America Act of any provision corresponding to Section 61 of the Commonwealth of Australia Constitution Act. In 1922, during a Privy Council hearing of an Australian case, Lord Haldane had occasion to make a similar observation when he asked, with reference to Section 61, and I quote, "Does it not put the sovereign in the position of having parted, so far as the affairs of the Commonwealth are concerned, with every shadow of active intervention in their affairs and handing them over, unlike the case of Canada, to the Governor-General," unquote. As Australia prepared for the first visit by a remaining monarch in 1954, Prime Minister Robert Menzies asked the Solicitor General, Professor Kenneth Bailey, for a legal opinion as to whether the Queen could carry out any constitutional duties while she was in Australia. The Solicitor General advised that nothing could be done except by way of a constitutional amendment under Section 128 of the Constitution to delegate the Governor-General's constitutional powers to the monarch. As Professor Bailey put it, and I quote from his legal opinion, "The executive power of the Commonwealth by Section 61 of the Constitution is declared to be vested in the Queen. It is also, in the same section, declared to be exercisable by the Governor-General as the Queen's representative. In the face of this provision, I feel it is difficult to contend that the Queen, even though present in Australia, may exercise in person functions of executive government which are specifically assigned by the Constitution to the Governor-General. The appointment of a Minister of State, Section 64, is an example." That 1953 opinion by the Solicitor-General confirmed that the Governor-General is not the Queen's delegate in the exercise of constitutional, that is, head of state powers and functions, and it explains why the Queen has never exercised any of these constitutional powers and functions. In 1975, the Commonwealth Solicitor-General, Maurice Byers, gave Prime Minister Whitlam a legal opinion in which he, the Solicitor-General, concluded that the royal instructions to the Governor-General were opposed to the words of the Constitution, that the executive power of the Commonwealth exercisable by the Governor-General under Chapter 2 of the Constitution may not lawfully be the subject of royal instructions, and that this had been the case since 1901. The Solicitor-General's opinion also dealt specifically with a widely held but incorrect view that the Governor-General, because of the description of the office as the Queen's representative, could therefore act only as her representative. The Solicitor-General went on to refer with approval to the views expressed in the Privy Council by Viscount Haldane in 1916 and 1922 in relation to Section 61 of the Australian Constitution, and he concluded his opinion with, "I think no place remains for instructions to the Governor-General." So, as I've already said, on the 21st of August 1984, on the advice of Prime Minister Bob Hawke, the Queen revoked Queen Victoria's letters patent relating to the office of Governor-General, all previous amending letters patent, and all royal instructions to the Governor-General, and issued new letters patent which strengthened the constitutional position of the Governor-General by not purporting to recreate the office as the original letters patent had done, and by acknowledging the creation of the office by the Australian Constitution. In 1988, the Hawke Government's Constitutional Commission, in referring to the 1984 letters patent and the revocation of all royal instructions, reported, and I quote, "Although the Governor-General is the Queen's representative in Australia, the Governor-General is in no sense a delegate of the Queen. The independence of the office is highlighted by changes which have been made in recent years to the royal instruments relating to it." So, to summarise the position, under Section 2 of the Constitution, the Governor-General is the Queen's representative and exercises certain royal prerogative powers and functions. Under Section 61 of the Constitution, the Governor-General is the holder of a quite separate and independent office created not by the Crown, but by the Constitution, and empowered to exercise in his own right as Governor-General and not as a representative or delegate of the Queen, all powers and functions of Australia's head of state. As Dr. Henderson has placed such reliance on the view of the Attorneys General that it is appropriate and proper to describe the Queen as our head of state, I should like to conclude by referring to Darrell Williams in particular, the first law officer of the Crown who put aside legal impartiality and became a partisan Republican during the 1999 referendum campaign. When Prime Minister Keating launched his Republican campaign in 1995, he proposed that the President would inherit all of the powers of the Governor-General without alteration, and he referred to the Governor-General as head of state. At least he realised how impossible it would be to argue that the Governor-General was not a head of state, but that a president with exactly the same powers and functions would be a head of state. When Darrell Williams became Attorney General in 1996, he sought to assist the Republican campaign that claimed that the Governor General was not our head of state. So in January 1998, just before the February 1998 Constitutional Convention, the Attorney General's Department published a revised pocket edition of Australia's Constitution. In an introduction headed Overview, there appeared for the first time the words, and I quote, "Australia's head of state is Queen Elizabeth II," unquote. Despite repeated written requests, neither the Attorney General nor his department have been able to provide any supporting documentary evidence nor any constitutional or legal justification for describing the Queen as head of state, apart from it being appropriate and proper. I'm delighted to report that in the most recent edition of Australia's Constitution, the assertion that the Queen is Australia's head of state has been removed. Now, you see, Gerard, our mate, the Governor-General, does have that gig after all. In our democracy, Republicans have a perfect right to seek to change our Constitution and to alter our system of government. But the onus is on them to produce their Constitution and to convince a majority of us that it would be better than the one we have now. This they will never do by resorting to meaningless plebiscites, stupid stunts, and silly slogans. My challenge to the Republicans is this: comply with Section 128 and show us your Constitution.
We don't want to lose any monikers. I think you should go down by the stairs. Now, if you go down by the stairs and come around here. Yeah. Also, there's a matter of insurance. And Helen. Well, you can come up that way, but I go down by the stairs.
And thanks for keeping the time.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to respond to Sir David's case. It's a very interesting case, and of course I accept perfectly well that the legal opinions he refers to are real legal opinions, that they exist and that they come from legal experts. But for every legal opinion that says one thing, you have, at least along these lines, another legal opinion that says the other. And so here's mine. It's a very interesting case, as I said. Sir David says, as you've heard, that we have an Australian head of state, that the Queen has no constitutional powers in Australia, and that no change is needed to the Constitution because the Australian people have been sovereign since 1901. Well, I question the first of these statements, but I do agree with the last, and I have worked on constitutional history and taught constitutional law for many years, and I agree that the Australian people had in the Constitution full sovereignty in 1901. But to conclude that the Australian people have always been constitutionally sovereign requires a particular perspective on the otherwise deceptive words of the Constitution. Interestingly, that's a perspective that was held by the late Justice Lionel Murphy before others held it, and some on the High Court subsequently came to hold it, and others like Sir David Smith have come to hold it. But it is possible for the Australian people to be sovereign, and they exercise that sovereignty, I agree entirely, through Section 128 of the Constitution, which allows them to change the Constitution if they wish. It's possible for them to be sovereign and still to have the Queen as Australia's head of state. So Sir David's case for sovereignty is interesting because he sounds, in fact, like a Republican. A Republican who wants to tweak constitutional history to show that Australia has never had the Queen as head of state and has never been under British constitutional authority. But of course, Sir David is a monarchist and he is a conservative. And conservatives hate change. That is, they hate it until it has happened. They happily point to changes that have occurred in the past as signs of the adaptability of society, of its growth, and of its organic wisdom, and as evidence that no further change is needed. Yet when the changes that the Conservatives so warmly defend and rely upon were first proposed, the Conservative response was just as it is today with respect to the proposal that the Constitution should be changed. Don't change anything. Change is dangerous. Unforeseen consequences may result. Things are fine just as they are. Sir David has told us that we have already an Australian head of state in the Governor General, and that Australia is now constitutionally independent of Britain. If that is so, it is not because Conservatives like Sir David welcomed such changes when these were proposed in the past. They didn't say, let's give ourselves an Australian Governor General so that future Republican change will never be necessary. Not at all. When Sir Isaac Isaacs was proposed by Labor Prime Minister James Scullin as Australia's first native-born Governor-General in 1930, there was a Conservative outcry in Australia. An Australian, it was said, would never be able to fill the role with the necessary impartiality and dignity. An Australian would be mixed up with Australian politics and would not command respect. Only a British-born and educated Governor-General could do the job. Well, the Prime Minister persisted, and Sir Isaac was appointed, and he filled, as I'm sure Sir David would agree, filled the role with probity and dignity, and the sky did not fall in. When the Statute of Westminster, the British Act that ended Britain's unilateral legislative power to pass laws for the Dominions, was ratified by the Curtin government in 1942, Conservatives in Australia responded similarly. Ratification, they said, would mean the collapse of the empire. It would undermine the war effort and give encouragement to our enemies. It would leave Australia henceforth vulnerable and alone. They said similar things about the Australian Citizenship Act of 1949, about the various acts that ended most appeals to the Privy Council, and about the changes to Queen Elizabeth's Style and Titles Act, especially the 1975 change that made Her Majesty Queen of Australia in her own right, in Australia's own right. Sir David, in his book, is particularly attached to the latter as evidence that the Queen is Australia's monarch, and the fact that she is almost always absent from the country is irrelevant, it seems. The one thing Conservatives didn't object to was the Australia Act of 1986, which the Queen herself proclaimed during her visit to Australia that year. This act closed the last avenues of appeal from state supreme courts to the Privy Council and ended the exercise of British powers with respect to the constitutions of the Australian states. It should not be thought that the Crown, both Her Majesty in person and Her Majesty's British government, did not actually exercise any such powers before 1986. It should not be thought that the powers were merely a historical relic. In fact, the British Crown was far more active and intrusive in Australian affairs up to this time, and I'm speaking of the Crown in the person of the Queen as well as the British government, up to this time than many people realise. Anne Toomey's latest book, called The Chameleon Crown, which has just been published by Federation Press, includes much hitherto unresearched archival material that reveals just how much the Crown was actively involving itself in Australian matters prior to 1986. It also, interestingly, reveals how obstructive the current Commonwealth government has been to the archival research that she has undertaken, notwithstanding the Prime Minister's declared attachment to greater study of Australian history. But now, Sir David tells us, everything has been sorted out, change happened, it's all fine, no more change is needed. What Conservatives are worried about really is the future, the very fact that there will be a future. They want things to stay still, to remain just as they are. The future is inherently uncertain. No one can know what is waiting for us, either personally or for our country, or for the world, indeed. Uncertainty is risky. Anything might happen. So, conservatives say, we've had changes in the past, that's enough, let's not make any more. Well, there are several things to say in response to this position. The first is, of course, that not all change is dangerous. Conservatives do accept this, since they can see that changes in the past have been beneficial. Even Edmund Burke, the Prime Minister's favourite, who is so seriously misused by politicians in Australia, supported change. In his Reflections on the Revolution in France, written in 1790, he wrote famously that a state without the means of some change is without the means of its conservation. Without such means, it might even risk the loss of that part of the Constitution which it wished the most religiously to preserve. The principles of what Burke called conservation and correction, he wrote, allow an adaptation to change at the same time as maintaining the whole fabric. Burke was, of course, thrilled that the monarchy had been restored in England after the English Civil War. He considered the monarchy to be an essential part of the British Constitution, and he was probably right. But he also supported Irish independence and the right of the Americans to break from Britain. Even Burke didn't think that a part of the empire could not function without the monarch. Sir David will probably respond that the Queen is an integral part of the whole fabric of the Australian Constitution. Whether she's the head of state or not is a secondary question. I say that the constitutional fabric, what we are all committed to retaining, is Australian democracy, not monarchy, democracy. There's no way in the world that substituting an Australian head of state for the Queen is going to undermine Australia's constitutional democracy. In fact, it will strengthen it. We will have in Australia a head of state who represents the Australian people. We will have a head who is chosen either directly or indirectly by the Australian people, not chosen by the lottery of birth. We will have a head whose message will be to Australians, you are good enough to have one of your own at the apex of your constitution. Even if the Queen is not actually head of state, even if Sir David is right on this, it would strengthen Australian democracy to end our attachment to the British monarch. A monarchy may be compatible with democracy, but it is not symbolically democratic, especially when the monarch in question represents, in practice, in her everyday life, the people of another country. Sir David tells us that the Queen is not named in the Constitution as head of state. Indeed, the words head of state don't appear at all in the Constitution. That's true. It's also true that the Constitution doesn't name the Governor General as head of state either. So the absence of the words from the Constitution gives no comfort to Sir David's case. But an absence of words isn't decisive. The words Prime Minister don't appear in the Constitution either, nowhere at all. Yet that doesn't mean that John Howard isn't the Prime Minister. Sir David says that the Governor General performs all the tasks of the Queen, all the tasks that the Queen would perform if she really were Australia's head of state. This is true in the day-to-day sense. But when the Queen is visiting Australia, notwithstanding arrangements that may be made to relieve her of any duties or to not to place her in an embarrassing position with respect to executive duties, she is entitled to perform the tasks that the Governor-General would perform in her absence. The Royal Powers Act of 1953 still says, when the Queen is personally present in Australia, any power under an act exercisable by the Governor-General may be exercised by the Queen. This act has not been repealed. Why does the Queen take precedence over the Governor-General if he, rather than she, is head of state? Why does the Constitution say that the executive power of the Queen of the Commonwealth is vested in the Queen and is exercisable by the Governor-General as the Queen's representative? Why use those words if they are merely descriptive and not prescriptive? Why, if the Queen is not the head of state, does she commission and decommission the Governor-General? The commission is issued in her name. Sure, she acts on the advice of the Australian Prime Minister in doing so, but that's what a head of state does in a parliamentary democracy. And why does the Constitution unequivocally name the Governor-General as Her Majesty's representative in the Commonwealth if their offices are separate? Why does the Constitution say that the Governor-General exercises such powers and functions of the Queen as Her Majesty may be pleased to assign to him? Why, if the Queen is not the head of state, did her consort, the Duke of Edinburgh, open the Melbourne Olympic Games in 1956 on her behalf? Nothing relevant has changed in the Constitution since 1956, at least in its references to the Queen or the Governor-General. Why was there so much confusion about who should open the Sydney Olympics in 2000? The Charter of the International Olympics Committee says that the Games shall be proclaimed open by the head of state of the host country. Why wasn't it immediately obvious that the Governor-General, Sir William Dean, was the one to do the job if he, not the Queen, was Australia's head of state? Why did the Prime Minister, John Howard, offer to do the job himself before finally giving in to popular pressure and asking Sir William to do it? And why, if the Queen is not Australia's head of state and if none of this matters, does Sir David object to changing the Constitution so that it reflects what he regards as reality? If the Governor-General is really Australia's head of state, why not change the Constitution so that it says that the Governor-General is Australia's head of state? You can't insist that something is so and at the same time insist that we cannot write down that it is so. Sir David, it seems, likes the idea of an Australian head of state. He is happy with calling Michael Jeffrey our head of state, but he still wants the Queen to be there in the background. That's fine. She can be there as head of the Commonwealth, still linked to us by this historical association, just as we are still historically linked to other former members of the British Empire. I loved the film The Queen. I have seen it twice, in fact, and if you haven't seen it, I recommend it warmly. See it after you've read Anne Toomey's book. Although my father was Dutch, I know I wouldn't find a film about the Dutch royal family anywhere near as fascinating as I found the film The Queen. That's because Australia's culture has drawn so much from its British heritage, including, of course, its Republican Irish heritage. And because in my childhood in the 1950s and 60s, the Queen, along with Sir Robert Menzies and the Women's Weekly, were embedded in the daily fabric of the fabric of daily life. But all of that has changed, and if popular magazines are anything to go by, Australia now has shares in the Danish royal family. And if Australian citizens want to take a copy of the Women's Weekly with them when they travel, they can read about Crown Princess Mary's latest adventures while they wait in the very long queue for non-entities at Heathrow Airport. So let's have a mate, or a mate-ess, for head of state. It makes sense, it won't hurt, it won't bring down the skies. It would put the final icing on the Australia Day cake and make us proud, as we were when we wrote our own constitution 110 years ago. Proud to know that both our institutions and our symbols can be our own, that we can manage them ourselves like most of the world manages theirs, and that no Australian political or constitutional office is closed to us just because we are Australian.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.